Hello, welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm your host, Kate Swanell, and I'm the journal's news and online editor. Our topic this week is total knee arthroplasty, and my guests today are two co-authors of a new narrative review which examines who should have a knee replacement and how patients can be optimised for surgery. Associate Professor Justine Naylor is Senior Principal Research Fellow at the University of New South Wales and the Ingham Institute, and Dr. Sam Adie is an orthopaedic surgeon at the St. George and Sutherland Hospital in Sydney. Welcome both to the pod. We're talking total knee replacements and who should have them and who should make that decision. So how many total knee replacements are we talking about? How many are performed in Australia and how does that rank with other nations?
So at the moment, over 55,000 people or procedures are being done in Australia, and most of those, 97%, are due to osteoarthritis. Now, that the number per 100,000 in Australia is around 242 procedures per 100,000 people, and that number is higher than the average OECD average, which is sitting at around 126 per 100,000. So in terms of how we compare with other countries, it looks like our numbers are pretty high, but we don't know if that is because we've got a higher system capacity than other places. So in other words, we've got a very large private sector that's helping get knee arthroplastic procedures done. Or we don't know if we're over-servicing. So we don't know the answer to that. But relatively speaking, yes, our numbers per 100,000 are higher than other countries in the OECD.
The other fascinating thing, Kate, is thinking about the lifetime risk of total knee arthroplasty. We know from, pretty new data that's been published that if you're a female, then your risk of having a total knee arthroplasty is about 20% at some point during your lifetime. If you're a male, it's 15%. So in other words, one in five females are going to get a total knee arthroplasty at some point in their life, and one in seven males. And that really just puts it into context. This is a massive public health issue.
Is it because we're too fat?
Partly. Yeah. We're living longer. So we've got longer to complain about arthritic pain.
Yes.
And we're also getting fatter.
Yeah.
So the two together are seeming to contribute to an increase in demand, need for knee arthroplasty.
So at the moment, what are the minimum criteria for a patient to undergo a TKA?
So, you know, this question, if you ask me as a clinician, is actually a really straightforward question because during our specialty training, it's drummed into us that, you know, patients with osteoarthritis have very well-recognized symptoms and signs such as pain, stiffness, swelling, deformity of the related joint, and you often have x-rays, just plain x-rays, that confirm the radiological signs of osteoarthritis. So from a clinician point of view, the answer is actually quite straightforward. I can tell you that the minimum criteria for someone who is a potential candidate for total knee arthroplasty surgery is someone with all of those signs that is essentially being limited by those symptoms and signs, and also has radiologic changes consistent with osteoarthritis, and their disease hasn't responded to any other treatment.
Yep.
So there's lots of other sort of non-surgical treatments that we can offer. And when it gets to the stage where those treatments become ineffective and the patient is essentially ready to undertake the surgery in terms of ready to, I guess, accept the risks of the surgery, then arthroplasty is a good option. Where it becomes more woolly, Kate, is that how do we make that actually scientific? So what we don't really know is what are the patient characteristics that actually result in the greatest benefits from surgery. So gains can be in terms of like symptoms and function or even the longevity of the prosthesis, or even gains to society. If you're looking at it from other frames, you know, from other perspectives, gains for the, I guess, the funder, the payer, or society. And those are issues that we've tried to address in this review, but you'd be surprised in terms of how lacking the scientific evidence is in this area.
Let's talk about age first. How young is too young and how old is too old?
Just from the outset, the average age of someone having a total knee arthroplasty in Australia is 69.
Right.
So I guess that's, you know, I don't want to be politically incorrect, but that's sort of a relatively older age. I guess the short answer here is there really isn't any age cutoff because Total knee arthroplasty is widely regarded as one of the best operations that we have. So it doesn't really make sense to limit access if someone can potentially benefit from the surgery. And we do know that even the very young or the relatively older patient can still gain quite large symptomatic and functional improvements from knee arthroplasty, similar to other patients. What we do know, however, is there are certain risks associated with different age groups. So, for example, if you are a younger patient, then you're going to have a higher lifetime risk of revision. And that's simply because you're just going to live longer.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to be more likely to wear out that prosthesis. And we do know that younger patients tend to also be more active.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just thinking about this biomechanically, the cycles that that prosthesis undergoes is probably much larger over the lifetime of that prosthesis in a younger patient than it is in an older patient. So it's likely that you're going to need a revision at some point in your life. And we do know that the younger patient has a 3 times higher risk of overall revision than the older patient. And then when you think about the on the older end of the spectrum, you know, older patients tend to have more comorbidities and their surgical risk is higher. And we do know from the joint replacement registry or our joint replacement registry that patients who are on the older end of the spectrum, so more than 90, do have a higher early mortality. So we're talking about within 30 days of about 8 per 1,000. And when you compare that to younger patients, so less than 80-year-olds have a mortality of about 1 per 1,000 in the first 30 days. So there is clearly a difference. But when you think about it, that risk is actually quite low. So we're talking about less than 1% here. I guess if the symptoms and signs warrant the surgery, then that should be discussed. I guess the risk should be discussed with the patient, and there really is no strong age cutoff.
Just to put the age, the young and the old in perspective, though,
there's
only 6% of all the arthroplasty procedures are done in people less than 55 years, and only 5% of all procedures are done in people over 85 years. So, whilst the procedures are being done in some very young and very old people, the majority are hovering around that average age of 69 years.
It's funny, when you were talking about the number of cycles that prosthesis will go through, I had this vision of, you know, when you go into an IKEA store and they have their chair and that thing pounding into it on every 2 seconds.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because the companies that create these prostheses actually do very similar things in their labs. So that's how they test it.
Wow.
You know, biomechanically in vitro.
Just see how long it can go till it breaks, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's move on to the question of gender. You mentioned earlier, Justine, that more women, 1 in 5 women will have a TKA. Are the risks different for the sexes?
Gender does make a bit of a difference, but only on a few things. So males tend to have a higher rate of revision than females for all age groups, and that may be related to the fact that maybe males tend to be more active. And the reason for the revision tends to be for infection. So there seems to be some relationship between males and the risk of infection, and then that leads to a greater rate of revision as well. So, yes, that's an aspect of where gender makes a difference. But on the other hand, males also tend to report better functional outcomes.
So being active has its good signs.
Yeah.
One of the fascinating things in your review that I found was the question of mental health issues in the patient. Do mental health issues affect outcomes? Are they a contraindication for surgery?
Very succinctly, having a history of a mental health issue, whether that be anxiety, depression, or some other mental health issue, it does affect your outcome. It can be seen in patient-reported outcomes. It can be seen in complications. It can be seen in length of stay. But these conditions in themselves are not contraindications. So what we need to do is not prevent people with mental health conditions from having the surgery, but we need to optimise their mental health condition prior to the surgery if we can.
It kind of leads into the question about patient expectation too, I guess. Is that an important predictor?
The short answer is it probably is because although the evidence is somewhat variable, from the evidence that we found, most of the studies that we found actually did show quite a strong association between patient expectation and particularly satisfaction with surgery. The problem we faced was the construct of patient expectation was measured in quite different ways across all of the evidence. We don't actually understand what patient expectation is and how to measure it. Mm. It's actually very difficult to make any conclusions about whether it actually results in a poorer or a better outcome.
I would have thought that if you expected too much, you're going to be disappointed, and if you don't expect enough, you're going to be pleasantly surprised. But
well, so would I. I guess from a clinician's point of view, that's what I face. If someone comes to me and has a really high degree of expectation from their prospective knee arthroplasty, then I tend to temper those expectations, and I remind them that that the average age of a knee arthroplastic patient is about 70, mm-hmm. and the prosthesis is made for older patients, and it's not going to be like their normal knee. It is, you know, made of, I guess, plastic and metal, and it's not going to feel like their normal knee.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of remind them all of these things to sort of temper their expectations. But at the same time, you don't want to, I guess, you know, dishearten them completely. You don't want to really lower their confidence in the surgery. It's a fine balance.
Just a question of mechanics, because this was fascinating me in the middle of the night when I was thinking about this podcast. Does a knee prosthesis have a kneecap?
So that's actually, Kate, you've opened up a big can of worms.
Excellent. Tell me more.
But the knee joint is made up of three compartments. So there's the medial, lateral, and the patellofemoral compartment. So
yes.
The patellofemoral compartment is the kneecap. When you do a knee replacement, you necessarily replace the medial and lateral compartments.
Mm-hmm.
You have the option of actually replacing the patella. And in Australia, we have a registry that demonstrates that it's actually a reasonably even split. I guess most people do replace the patella. There are some surgeons who opt to not replace the patella.
Do they leave the old one in, or do you just
They just leave your kneecap in, mm. and it articulates with the existing knee, the knee replacement. The issue, what's fascinating for our surgeons, is to look at how there's variations in patella resurfacing across the world. So if you look at, for example, the United States, pretty much everyone gets a patella resurfacing, or the patella or the kneecap is replaced. But if you look at certain places in Europe, like Scandinavia, hardly anyone gets their kneecap replaced.
Okay.
And if you look at the data, all of those patients are doing pretty much, you know, equivalently. So there's no real differences in the patients who actually have their kneecap resurfaced or not. And that has been subject to randomized trials. And as far as we know, you know, patients' function afterwards is pretty much equivalent. But what we do know is if someone comes to you and they've had a knee replacement and they're unhappy for one reason or another, then as a surgeon, I'm going to be thinking about the things that might be wrong with their knee. And I guess you can see how a surgeon who has a patient across them who doesn't have their kneecap replaced can start thinking about how the kneecap may be an issue for that patient, and perhaps offer them a revision surgery where the kneecap is actually replaced.
Mm.
So in Australia, anyway, joint replacements that have not had their kneecap replaced have a higher rate of revision, according to our joint replacement registry. I suspect it's because of that reason. Because of that reason that there is actually something that we can potentially fix, in inverted commas.
But might not be the problem.
Exactly, but it may not be the problem.
I'm chatting today with Associate Professor Justine Naylor from the University of New South Wales and orthopaedic surgeon Dr. Sam Adie. Their narrative review can be found at mja.com.au. Back to our chat. Given that the diseased knee is being removed, does it matter how severe the disease is in that to the outcomes of the surgery?
Clinically speaking, if a person's knee is very severe, and that is they have lots of pain or intractable pain, they may have muscle weakness, they may have instability, they may have knee flexion contracture, so the knee is very stiff. If you start with a very stiff knee or severe knee clinically, you start with a very low base, so high level of impairment. So there's much scope for recovery.
Yes.
So those people experience or tend to experience very large relative improvements in their signs and their symptoms. But if you start in better shape, so you have less impairment, you still experience some improvement, but there's less room to improve. So the gains you get aren't as great. So there is a relationship between the severity of your knee joint clinically and how much you improve afterwards.
Let's talk about the concept of value. And I guess it's kind of almost related to that previous question in terms of the amount of improvement you get afterwards. What does value look like when it comes to total knee replacements? What's a good value surgery?
Kate, that's a really good question, and it's one that's perplexing everybody in this space.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment in Australia, value is really only considered from the patient perspective. So that means if the patient needs it and they want it, they're likely to get it. We do not really consider value from the perspective of society or the payer, whether that be government or the funder. So so when we look at surgeon waiting lists and public waiting lists, we don't tend to discriminate based on who will get most value. It goes back to the idea of if the patient needs it based on all the signs and symptoms we talked about before, and the person wants it, so they've considered the risks and the benefits to them, the patient will likely get it. But as I said, we haven't really gone down the path of considering value from a society or funder's perspective. And that's because we haven't got consistency internationally of how to measure value. And we all have different understanding of what that value is. So until we decide what is good value, what is a good recovery, and what was worth the risk, we'll stick to value being at the from the perspective of the patient only.
Interesting, Kate, about this question is what's happening in the United States. So Justine touched upon, you know, different frames of reference when you're thinking about value. In the United States, and this is generating a lot of discussion in the arthroplastic community, is what's happening with bundled care payments. So this is a system that some insurers have adopted in America, where providers are essentially given a set amount for each episode of knee arthroplasty.
Yes.
And what that does essentially is it puts the burden of, I guess, the complications and the funding of those, of the consequences of those complications, on the provider.
Right.
So in other words, if a patient has a knee arthroplasty and then has, for example, an infection, you can imagine how the cost of that knee arthroplasty is going to really skyrocket in sort of multiple folds. What that really drives providers to do is actually, A, select patients based on who they perceive to have, you know, the lower risk, and B, to optimize those patients that have a perceived higher risk. And you can see the concern with that, even though it's a very good, I guess, you know, in inverted commas, capitalist solution. What the problem is that it might actually restrict access. And there's a lot of concern that you might actually restrict access to knee arthroplasty, which is, generally speaking, is a great surgery to only patients who have a perceived lower risk.
There's some research going towards developing tools to help predict outcomes at the individual level so we can determine who gets the most value at the individual level. But those studies haven't really achieved the goal of coming up with the one tool that's going to determine, who's going to get the most benefit or the most value out of this surgery.
Yeah.
So that's something that people are working on, but it's a very difficult space to be in, partly because of, as I said before, internationally we can't agree on what's the best metric to measure outcomes as well as value of the surgery.
Let's shift a little to the idea of optimising patients before surgery. Is there evidence for that? Does prehabilitation in that sense work?
Okay, from the outset, we should mention the type of evidence that we actually look for in relation to optimisation, because we asked ourselves, how are we actually going to assess the evidence when we're thinking about how to optimise someone for knee arthroplasty?
Mm-hmm.
And what we then decided is we are going to look for high-level evidence in terms of RCTs and meta-analyses that have assessed interventions aimed at optimising patients preoperatively, but then have measured post-operative outcomes. So in terms of, I guess, those interventions are aimed at mitigating the risks or improving your performance following knee arthroplasty. I guess the issue here is we found heaps and heaps of data that have described the risk factors for a poor outcome after knee arthroplasty.
Yep.
But what we didn't really find is good data to support interventions to actually mitigate those risks. But I just wanted to mention that from the outset, because prehabilitation is actually an area that has really, really strong evidence. So there's multiple RCTs, multiple meta-analyses that have pulled the evidence from those RCTs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's actually quite poor evidence to support routine use of prehabilitation. So the evidence is really strong. You know, we're talking about high-level evidence here in systematic reviews and meta-analyses, but we're only seeing very mild improvements post-operatively for someone who has undergone a prehabilitation program. So I guess it doesn't really warrant the inconvenience to both patients and providers, and also the cost, so it's not really very cost-effective. So we actually concluded that it shouldn't be routinely recommended before having a knee arthroplasty.
Okay, that's fair. So that's talking about prehabilitation designed to improve your mobility and your function and your strength. But getting back to your other idea about, well, is losing weight going to be beneficial for me?
Mm-hmm.
There isn't enough research in this space that says losing weight pre-surgery gives you better outcomes in both the short term and the long term, even though logically it makes sense that you should get better outcomes if you come in.
Is the benefit of the losing weight more about mitigating the risks of major surgery, though?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. So there's in theory multiple benefits of losing weight, and that's going to be mitigating the risks of anaesthetic and the surgery acutely. But also it has implications for your longer-term health, because we know that obesity has negative effects on many aspects of health. So, you know, diabetes, cholesterol, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
But also it has implications for the longevity of the prosthesis.
Let's talk about some other comorbidities that might be, if not contraindications, and certainly risk factors. Cardiac disease, for example, what's the evidence and what types of cardiac disease are contraindications for this surgery?
Kate, the answer to that is, again, we found lots and lots of evidence that describes some of the risk factors for a poor outcome after knee arthroplasty surgery,
mm-hmm.
and specifically thinking about patients with coronary artery disease, patients with a known diagnosis of heart failure, and patients with valvular disease, particularly aortic stenosis, all have much higher risks of catastrophic complications after knee arthroplasty. So we're talking about mortality postoperatively and a higher risk in terms of being twice as likely to die in the early stages after a knee arthroplasty,
okay.
For example, after if you have coronary artery disease. What we, again, don't really have is how to optimize those patients prior to them having the knee arthroplasty. We do have really good guidelines from professional associations, such as, the European Society of Cardiology, that have published a huge tome, essentially, of recommendations for how to optimize cardiac status before any surgery. We're not just talking specifically about knee arthroplasty. We don't have any specific interventions aimed at optimizing cardiac disease. We did find a small pilot trial, for example. This is the sort of evidence that we were looking for. Pilot trial that actually examined an exercise intervention aimed at improving cardiorespiratory status before having your knee arthroplasty. But it was only a very small pilot trial. So that's the sort of evidence that we actually really wanted to see. And unfortunately, it's lacking.
What about diabetes?
So diabetes, again, it increases your risks across the board. We know that there's a higher risk of infection, loosening of the prosthesis, venous thromboembolism, overall revision. But not just an increase in the risk, but it also actually results in lower function postoperatively. So we do know that patients with diabetes have a higher risk of having severe functional limitations postoperatively when you compare them to non-diabetic patients. So really there's a strong rationale here to optimize diabetic patients preoperatively. But again, we didn't really find any high-level evidence. What we wanted to see was a randomized trial, for example, looking at different ways to optimize diabetic patients. But we didn't really find that. We did find a lot of discussion about optimizing serum markers or serum markers of glucose control, such as HbA1c. But again, that was quite variable. So if you just looked at the traditional cutoff of good control of diabetes, 7%, or I think it's 60 millimoles per liter in the new units of measurement, there actually wasn't very good evidence to show that those patients actually have a higher risk. But when you get to that higher levels of HbA1c, so 8% or 64 millimoles per litre, that's when you start seeing patients with a higher risk of complications.
What's the mechanism at play in terms of diabetes and the functioning of the prosthesis itself?
I guess, if you have a complication, then you're going to have a poorer outcome overall. So that in terms of it being revision surgery or having poorer function afterwards. So for example, if you imagine if you have a wound complication or an infection, that's going to lead to you having poorer function. But we also know that diabetic patients have a higher risk of arthrofibrosis or a very stiff knee postoperative. And I'm not really sure about the actual mechanisms for that. They probably generate, more scar tissue around the joint afterwards. We're not really sure about the mechanism. We do know that diabetes is associated with other conditions that result in a stiff joint, such as a frozen shoulder, for example. So there is some underlying mechanism there. So all of those, I guess, are possible explanations for why a diabetic patient can have poorer function afterwards.
The impression I'm getting from this conversation and from your review is that we need a whole bunch more research done. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely, Kate. At the moment, we're borrowing data from other conditions to help inform how we optimise people for surgery. And that may or may not be entirely appropriate. We may need to be a bit more specific and start looking at, what do specific interventions do, how effective specific interventions are, specifically for total knee arthroplasty.
Is there enough funding around for this kind of research, or is there something else in the way of doing it?
You can never have enough funding, Kate.
Of course. Silly question.
but I guess the short answer to that is things are noticeably getting better. From my own perspective, the research culture in Australia has dramatically improved in the last few years. I think there's a lot of energy and drive. And in fact, we recently had a visiting researcher from the UK recently who commented on that, who commented on a quite a noticeable, palpable difference in the atmosphere that he found in Australia when compared to the UK, which I found really, really interesting. So things are very positive. I think the things are moving in the right direction. I think there is generally more funding. I think there's generally more drive and interest. I think consumers are now getting involved and general population is now picking up on things that they actually want these things to happen. So I think all of those are really, really important positive factors.
The one question I forgot to ask was about smoking cessation. Does the timing of that matter in terms of outcomes?
So I guess, if someone comes to you and they're a smoker, Kate, we should be talking about smoking cessation regardless.
Yes.
Know that there's health benefits in almost every fee when you're talking about someone stopping smoking. But and specifically talking about a knee replacement, any time of cessation is important. We know that even if they stop a day or two before the surgery, it can mitigate some of the anaesthetic risks. In terms of thinking about the joint, in terms of mitigating the risk of, for example, wound healing or the development of an infection, the data suggests that you need to cease smoking approximately 4 weeks preoperatively so that you can have an equivalent risk to someone who's a non-smoker. And I think that's quite an important thing to share with the patient, with the smoking patient who's a potential candidate for knee arthroplasty.
Thank you both very much for your time. Great subject.
Thank you so much.
No worries.
Thanks, Kate. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Justine. See you. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.